Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, another do-or-die vote on the Affordable Care Act at the Supreme Court, and it was another victory for the Obama administration. The High Court upheld the legality of the tax subsidies in all 50 states under the Affordable Care Act, a decisive win for health reform in this country.
Indeed, it was a do and not a die, Mark. Conservative opponents of the law argued that, based on literal interpretation of language in the law, the tax subsidies were only authorized in states that had set up their own insurance exchanges. But Chief Justice Roberts issued the majority opinion, siding with the Obama administration's view that the intent of the law was to make subsidies available to all Americans who qualified. And that, I think we can say, is a real victory, not just for the president, but for the law itself, and most importantly, for the millions of Americans who are insured under it now.
Well, Margaret, it seemed like a heavyweight 10-round battle that we've been in. There have been 50 or 60 repeal efforts. There's been high court rulings, lower court rulings. And so the 10 rounds are over, but it looks like people think it's a 15-round fight. It's probably going to go into the next presidential election.
But meanwhile, families and individuals are able to continue with affordable insurance under the Affordable Care Act. And we know that the conservative opponents may have been blocked in the nation's highest court. We'll let those legislative challenges continue. And our guest today is somebody who knows quite a bit about this process.
Bill Hoagland was a longtime policy operative in Congress and is now a senior vice president at the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington, a think tank dedicated to finding bipartisan solutions to the nation's biggest challenge. His focus is on economics and health policy. He also authored the Bipartisan Council's 2013 report on patient-centered care and cost containment in healthcare. He'll give us an analysis of the Supreme Court decision.
And Laurie Robertson will be stopping by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org is being kept pretty busy vetting the claims of the numerous presidential hopefuls entering the fray. This week, she looks at healthcare claims made by candidate Donald Trump.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Bill Hoagland in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. More Americans like it than don't. Obamacare, that is. According to a CBS New York Times poll, an overwhelming majority of Americans polled felt the tax subsidies just recently upheld by the Supreme Court were a good thing, a full 70% of those polled. And now a majority of Americans, some 47% versus 43%, say they like Obamacare. In comparison, back in 2010, only 21% of those Americans polled had a favorable view. 55% of Americans feel the law has good things to recommend it and should not be repealed, but just improved upon. There are still some challenges ahead. A number of GOP leaders are vowing more repeal efforts in Congress. Certain sectors of the population are still not rushing to sign up for health coverage, especially younger adults and Latinos. And there are still coverage challenges in states where Medicaid was not expanded. Still, more than 60 million Americans have gained coverage since the launch of the Affordable Care Act, bringing the uninsured rate to the lowest it's been in years. California has moved forward with a plan to ban personal objections for childhood vaccines. The measure will require all children entering kindergarten to have been vaccinated, that information to be compiled at the governor's office. California was the scene of a number of childhood disease outbreaks like measles and whooping cough. The measure stipulating the public good was more important than personal choice. So personal and religious exemptions end under this measure. And kids and ADHD, one of the leading causes of childhood prescriptions in this country. Now a new study out shows maybe it's best to let the kids fidget. The study in child neuropsychology looked at kids with and without ADHD. Both groups were fitted with a motion monitor and were given cognitive tasks to complete. The kids with ADHD who fidgeted the most during their cognitive test actually scored the highest. Conversely, fidgeting had no effect on the test results on the kids not diagnosed with ADHD. Studies suggest that hyperactivity may actually prove to be a benefit for those kids struggling to pay attention. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center, where he directs and manages health and economic policy. Mr. Hoagland spent 25 years working in the United States Senate, serving as Director of the Budget and Appropriations under the Majority Leader, Senator Bill Frist. He served as Staff Director of the Senate Budget Committee from 1986 to 2003. The National Journal listed Mr. Hoagland as one of the top 100 decision makers on Capitol Hill, and he received the James L. Blum Award for Distinguished Service in Budgeting. He coordinated the BPC's 2013 report, A Bipartisan RX for Patient-Centered Care and System-Wide Cost Containment. Mr. Hoagland is a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration, earned his degree from Purdue and Penn State. Mr. Hoagland, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Good afternoon. Welcome.
Well, it looks like it was a vindication and victory for the Obama administration as the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 to uphold the legality of the tax subsidies used to offset cost of purchasing health insurance for all Americans, and even those living in states that didn't set up their own insurance exchange. And this is the second major high court decision addressing the challenges to the Affordable Care Act. And some would say it essentially secures the health law's futures. Others would say, let's wait to the next presidential election. But could you tell our listeners what specifically was the dispute in the King versus Burwell and why it posed such a threat to the Affordable Care Act?
Yes, specifically the challenge came from the plaintiff King versus the administration, and Mr. King alleged that he was in a state that was not part of the state exchange, and therefore it was being run by the federal government. There are about 34 states that decided not to set up state exchanges but let the federal government run it. And some language within the law, and I'm not a lawyer, but the language within the law basically said that subsidies for purchasing health insurance on these exchanges would be available through the way it read if the state had an exchange. And so the argument was, well, if the state didn't set up the exchange and the federal government was running the exchange and the federal government is not a state, then these subsidies should not be available to those individuals in those 34 states. That was the challenge. It was straightforward. It was an interpretation of the language that was in the law. And the most important fact here being that, of course, the law had been implemented. It was operational. And in those 34 states, nearly 6.4 million Americans were receiving health insurance and were receiving subsidies. And had King won, then those 6.4 million individuals would have lost the subsidies necessary that they felt that was necessary for them to continue to purchase health insurance, and probably would have had to drop health insurance immediately had King won. So the decision by the court was no, this law was set up to provide health insurance to Americans, and the interpretation of the six justices was those state exchanges and federal exchanges, people purchasing insurance on the federal exchange was no different, and therefore current law stood. Subsidies continued, and those 6.4 million people that might have lost their subsidies and therefore lost their insurance continues on as status quo, no change in the law.
So, Bill, in the majority opinion upholding the tax subsidies for all Americans in whatever state they live in, Chief Justice Roberts noted that the intent of the law was to improve health insurance markets, not to destroy them, and, you know, really thus secures the Affordable Care Act as an important social safety net for, as you noted, 6.4 million individuals who might have lost the subsidies. So now that the High Court has concluded that the subsidies are illegal, what has this done to not only secure coverage for those individuals, but how has this really secured the Affordable Care Act into the foreseeable future and improved health insurance markets? Because obviously one of the big questions was, if all of those people lose their subsidies, what happens to the whole system, and is it tenable for health insurance to remain in it? Could you comment on that a bit?
Sure. This is, of course, the difficulty and the challenges associated with insurance going forward in terms of the actual operational aspects of insurance. You want as many people to participate and purchase insurance and have insurance in order to spread the risk across the entire body of population out there. So you want both the individuals that are healthy and those who potentially could be sick or are not so healthy. You want everybody in the pool, so to speak, to spread the risk and lower the cost. had this $6.4 million, as an example, dropped out of the health insurance market, then there was a likelihood that this would have driven up the premiums for those who remained purchasing health insurance. So the combination of this law was first, as the justices has indicated, was to preserve and protect and extend health insurance to all Americans. And therefore, that's one of the reasons why I believe the justices ruled in favor of keeping this 6.4 million people in the pool in those states to keep the insurance, the cost of the premiums at a lower level than it would have been for the other people in the state had those 6.4 dropped out. I think this indicates that the law remains in effect. It goes forward. It has taken on two major challenges. I will be as straight about this as I can. That does not necessarily mean that there won't continue to be challenges to the law, and particularly now the challenges shift from the judicial system to the legislative system.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican-controlled Congress has indicated that this does not mean the end of the battle with the Affordable Care Act, that now the battle moves back into the legislative process, if you like. And I would not be surprised in the least if later here you'll start to hear about a budget process that has been set up at the end of July. The Congress is likely to pass a law that repeals major elements of the Affordable Care Act, basically does what the Supreme Court might have done had it ruled the other way and eliminate a number of subsidies, and pass a law, because they can do that now with the control of the both chambers and under this thing we call budget reconciliation that avoids there having to be a 60-vote hurdle. And this law will likely be put on the president's desk. Now, he will veto it, and the veto will not be overridden, but we've not heard the end of this battle, I am afraid. The hope would be that even the president and Democratic members admit there are provisions in this law that probably could be improved. The law could be modified in certain areas. There are questions about whether or not the employer mandate is really functioning. There are other questions that need to be addressed, if there are other ways of being more efficient in the delivery of the premiums out there. And so as a consequence, my hope would be that we'll get through this, what I call kabuki dance, one more time. If Congress can pass this and put it on his desk and they vetoes it, then maybe we can get back to some serious discussion about reforms that both bipartisan Republicans and Democrats can work on going forward. And no law is perfect, and nobody says that this law is perfect. And it would be nice to get back to some, what I, obviously working for the Bipartisan Policy Center, would sit down and have some serious negotiations back and forth on those areas that can be improved in the law.
We're speaking today with Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center, where he directs and manages health and economic policy analysis. Before that, Mr. Hoagland served as Vice President of Public Policy at Cigna Corporation. Prior to that, he spent 25 years working in the United States Senate, serving as the Director of the Budget and Appropriations. Bill, you know, I want to get back to the, you know, pull the thread a little more on sort of the bipartisan nature of Congress right now. You spent your career really reaching across the aisles trying to craft economic policy, trying to build consensus, and that's really what the and yet there seems to be little of that type of cooperation here, particularly in this bill. I know, Margaret, we had David Gergen on the show, and David was, you know, he really lamented that the bill didn't have bipartisan support, and it's sort of at the root of this struggle. The American people, I think, are getting a little weary of this. You had 50 or 60 votes against it. Do you really think after the summer kabuki dance that we're going to get through to this, or are we going to have to wait, as some of the presidential candidates said, we're going to have one more referendum on this? Is there any end in sight?
I may be overly optimistic. I do think there's a recognition that there are areas that could be addressed in this law. Let's back up just for a second. And as you mentioned at the outset, I worked on the Hill, and I worked for Republicans in all those years up there. And we did strive to work across the aisle and find common ground where we could on a number of issues. And now there are partisan issues, and from time to time that you have to that happen, and there's nothing you can say about that other than it's partisan. But on this, something on major pieces of legislation, whether it's Social Security, whether it's Medicare, whether it's taxes, you can't reform these particular policies in this country in a partisan way. It has to be done in a bipartisan way. And the sad part about this particular piece of legislation, as David has indicated, it was put together in a partisan way. It was passed without any Republican support in the House or Senate. And quite frankly, the big problem from my perspective as an old staffer was that it passed the Senate, and what passed the Senate on that Christmas morning, that particular law did not go to conference. As you might recall, that at the end of that 2009, there was a special, it passed with 60 votes, Senate Republicans not voting for it, all Democratic votes. That's what they needed to get over a filibuster. And that particular law that passed that morning is basically went straight to the president, because we had a special election there in Massachusetts and changed the makeup of the Senate by one vote. And had that bill gone through the normal process, which would have been a conference between the House and Senate, there might have been some opportunity to address just this particular issue, the wording as it relates to state exchanges versus federal exchanges. The way the law went together, unfortunately, has created a number of the problems and the judicial challenges that have come to pass. So I go back, I'm not answering your question, I guess I'm filibustering a little bit here. I remain hopeful that on those major issues we can still come together and find common ground. Now, I think you're right. I think we see people already talking, we have to change the president, we have to retain Republican control, and then that's the only way we'll repeal this law. I think there's a lot of pieces of this law, quite frankly, Republicans like. Coverage up to the age of 26, no pre-existing conditions. A number of these provisions are positive, and in fact, were Republican proposals many years ago. And so I think we have we now are unfortunately going to be moving into presidential politics, and I presume this will become another issue for the election. I wish it were not the case. I wish we could say, this is the law, let's work together to improve it, where we have an agreement that there are areas that need to be improved. This is critical that we have a system that provides health insurance to as many Americans as needed, and to improve our delivery system in a way that's most cost effective to everybody out there. So I'm hopeful. I think we will unfortunately go through another process here in a couple of months. Then we'll have to see whether people say, okay, that's it, let's now sit down, or do we have to wait for a presidential election to go through this again?
Well, one thing I think we can agree on is that students of public policy will be studying this one for a long time to come.
It's kind of the test
case on everything from why voting is important to the political process. But there are many times when it feels like the Affordable Care Act is entirely about coverage and insurance. But it's also about the care. It's about quality of care. It's about patient-centered care.
Right.
It's about cost. And you authored the Bipartisan Policy Center's 2013 report, A Bipartisan Prescription for Patient-Centered Care and System-Wide Cost Containment. So share with our listeners, if you will, from your perspective and based on all your experience, where do we pick up from here, kind of post seeing the ACA remaining largely intact at this point? Where do we pick up to make these notions of patient-centered care, which is another way of saying safe, quality, satisfying care and cost containment, a reality? What is the prescription for that?
Well, I think Congress, though they may not want to admit it, has started to even move in that direction that we had outlined with the report that we had put together, but Tom Daschle, Dr. Bill Frist, Senator Domenici, and Dr. Alice Rivlin a few years ago. But the kernels of the improvement process were embedded within the Affordable Care Act, and that is something called Accountable Care Organizations, ACOs. And these accountable care organizations talk about restructuring essentially the payment system in such a way that we move away from paying fee for service for individuals, so we move to paying for the quality of the product that that's delivered. Now, it's not easy, and it will continue to be controversy. Health and Human Services is experimenting some models on this. But the approach is to move it away from just paying for a service, but paying for the quality and changing our reimbursement system. So the key that came out of our particular study, and as I say, is starting to be implemented around the country and in the private sectors of these collaborative care organizations, it does talk about the restructuring of the delivery system in a way that includes the hierarchy from hospital to physician to pharmacist to home health care delivery. It puts the whole system of health care into one basket, as opposed to simply going to the doctor when you're sick and getting the medicine and forgetting it. It's a culture of health issue that we have to focus on, and that was one of the major elements of our proposal. I think we're moving in that direction. I think it's a system that's going to take some time, but to me that is the answer, is to change the payment system and to reward quality as opposed to just rewarding paying for the number of services a doctor or a hospital might deliver.
You know, we had Governor Deval when he was, and he was also focusing on the first element of the bill around healthcare in Massachusetts was really about access, really thinking about how to get good outcomes and how to control cost. That is something that clearly is the next step here. You know, tell us a little bit, Bill, about the Bipartisan Center. What's going on there? And because this is a very important group, and the work you do is vital for the country.
The Bipartisan Policy Center, as its name would imply, is not nonpartisan. It is bipartisan. It is Republicans who feel strongly and Democrats who feel strongly about their position. It was established 8 years ago by four former majority leaders of the United States Senate. Senator Bob Dole recently passed away, of course, Senator Hal Baker on the Republican side, Senator Tom Daschle, and Senator George Mitchell. And the four leaders came together who had worked through the Congress when it was more bipartisan and was more accommodating to understand the other person and to work with the other person to come to solutions, to focus initially on such issues as energy policy, and that's where it began, but we cover a number of areas. It's focused on right now a number of areas in healthcare that I'm involved in, obviously cost containment being one of them. We're also focusing on long-term healthcare, one of the other major elements that was not addressed in the Affordable Care Act, long-term institutional or non-institutional or home-based care. How do we address that? In fact, in fairness, I guess I should say, the Affordable Care Act did have a provision called the CLASS Act, and it was pulled out at the end because it was could not operate from the actuarial perspective. So that issue still remains a big issue. We're focusing on prevention issues. We have a former Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman and Veneman and Donna Shalala, who are involved with working with us on prevention issues. Part of this healthcare issue is really goes back to culture of life, what we eat, how we exercise. Those are major elements in terms of preventing costs going forward in healthcare. So we're focusing on those three elements. Health innovation, big issue. Issues associated with health information technology, the transference of information. We're also focusing right now on Food and Drug Administration, and because here's another area where we're talking about cost is, and that are some of these drugs that are coming onto the market are extremely expensive, and is that appropriate? Is it right? This gets very difficult because then we're getting into some ethical issues as to whether they should or should not be charging prices for such large drugs. And then on the fiscal side, I remain, as an old budgeteer, I remain focused on the long-term debt of this country and are there a way to address that. So a number of factors. We are always busy, and thank you for the call out for the Bipartisan Policy Center.
Great. And we've been speaking today with Bill Hoagland, Senior Vice President of the Bipartisan Policy Center. You can learn more about their work by going to bipartisanpolicy.org. And Bill, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In his speech announcing that he was running for president, Donald Trump claimed that under Obamacare, health care premiums were going up 29, 39, 49, even 55%. That's misleading. He's talking about proposed rate increases for 2016 for some plans on the individual market, but it's unclear whether such increases will be approved by state insurance regulators. And other plans have proposed decreases in rates or single-digit increases. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to submit any proposed rate increase above 10% for individual and small group market plans to state and federal regulators for review. These plans would be sold on the state and federal exchanges, as well as through insurance brokers for individuals buying their own plans. Most Americans get their insurance coverage through work, and their premiums have been rising at low rates recently. The average family plan premium for employer policies went up 3% from 2013 to 2014. But the individual market is different. Insurers must now accept anyone who wants insurance, and they can't charge policyholders more based on health status, like they used to. Trump cites a 55% increase, and in fact, there are plans that have requested increases that high and even above. In New Mexico, for instance, where Blue Cross Blue Shield plans that reduced premiums for 2015 now want to increase them substantially. But the published rate requests only include those that are above 10%. In Indiana, four of the nine insurance companies selling plans on the exchange are proposing to decrease premiums, and the largest insurer has proposed a 3.8% increase, according to the Indianapolis Star. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Tens of millions of people around the world have conditions that make it impossible for them to speak on their own, requiring them to adopt a computerized voice box for communicating. Perhaps the most well-known of these folks is the physicist Stephen Hawking.
I would have thought it was fairly obvious what I meant.
The problem is, that sound of Hawking speaking through his voice box is the same voice sound, say, that a 10-year-old girl with a neurologic disorder might be forced to use as well, because there just haven't been many voice options on the market.
In the U.S. alone, there are 2.5 million Americans who are unable to speak. That's millions of people worldwide who are using generic voices, including Professor Hawking, who uses an American-accented voice.
At a recent TED Talk, speech researcher and innovator Dr. Rupal Patel shared a program she has launched that can change that reality, Vocal ID.
There had to be a way to reverse engineer a voice from whatever little was left over. We set out to create custom-crafted voices that captured their unique vocal identities.
Creating a voice bank of donor voices that will allow voices to be individualized for each unique patient seeking to communicate through an electronic voice box, melding a donated voice with a footprint of whatever natural sounds the person is able to make.
Why don't we take the source from the person we want the voice to sound like and borrow the filter from someone about the same age and size, because they can articulate speech, and then mix them. Because when we mix them, we can get a voice that's as clear as our surrogate talker and is as similar in identity to our target talker.
Since this popular TED Talk, 16,000 people have signed up to be voice donors at the Human Voice Bank Initiative. So volunteers, like this little girl, will read a series of simple phrases over a several-hour period.
Things happen in pairs. I love to sleep. The sky is blue without clouds.
And then those phrases are matched with the voice footprint of the patient being provided for.
This voice is only for me. I can't wait to use my new voice with my friends.
Such speech synthesis will give that person the dignity of a speaking voice that is as closely matched to their own identity as possible.
They say that giving blood can save lives. Giving your voice can change lives.
Dr. Patel, who's a professor of computer engineering at Northeastern University, has launched the website vocalid.com.
I imagine a whole world of surrogate donors from different sizes, different ages, coming together to give people voices that are as colorful as their personalities.
And with the bank of voice donors now building around the world, Dr. Patel expects that patients with conditions ranging from muscular dystrophy to Lou Gehrig's disease or stroke will be given the chance to communicate in a voice made just for them. The Human Voice Bank Initiative, matching vocal donors with millions of people who seek to authentically communicate with friends and family in a voice that most closely matches what would be their own. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.